Hi, Trailblazers. This is Jeremy LaDuke, and I wanted to let you know about a book I just wrote called Climb, The Risks and Rewards of Elevating Your Brand. It is a nuts and bolts marketing trail guide to help any local business owner find their way through a dense marketing forest. But it's not just a lot of technical marketing jargon. It follows the story of a Main Street bookshop owner as she works to revitalize her family business. And you get to see some practical, everyday ways these tactics can be used. If you'd like more info or to get your copy, please visit theclimb.guide or search for Climb by Jeremy LaDuke wherever you get your books. And now, on to the show. Thanks for tuning in to Marketing Trailblazers, fireside chats with mountain-conquering CMOs, where we get to sit down with some of the marketing world's leading experts. I'm your host, Jeremy LaDuke.
And I'm Jess.
And today is roundabout. We're heading into spring 2024. So exciting stuff. I love where we live in East Tennessee. Well, like, I'm going somewhere with this.
I hope so.
I love where we live because it's like you go other places. I've gone other places and they have like maybe one or two seasons, right? Like if you go somewhere that's really extreme, it's like one season all the time. And then if you go somewhere that's kind of, they may have two. But like Tennessee, we have.
You get every season in 1 week sometimes.
Yes.
It's great. The planet's not dying at all.
But I like the whenever the actual seasons turn, it's like, oh yeah, this is spring. I forgot about this. The birds are chirping. Like, I went outside the other day and like the birds are just going nuts. And I was like, I haven't heard them in a long time. So it was nice. So you get like for people who like change, it's like you get that change 4 times a year.
You do. Yep. You do. I mean, yeah, I can't help but get a little bit excited when there's more green and everything's not gray and drab anymore.
Yeah, we do have crappy winters where it's just like
everything's gray.
We got some huge snow this year, but like most of the time it's just like light dusting, cold and wet. Yeah, so that change isn't fun, but the snow is cool this year.
Yeah.
Did you get out in it? Did you do sledding or snowman or build igloos or anything?
We waited too long for a snowman because then when we tried towards the end, too icy and it wasn't like
oh yeah
but we did sled before it iced over and that was fun, and then we sledded.
Yeah,
used to sled.
See, we get so little snow we don't even know how to say that word.
After it got icy and flew down the hill.
Oh yeah, I bet. Yeah,
it was fun.
Yeah, like we always wait till like it's too late to get sleds because we don't have like a sled we keep at the house.
Okay.
Because we just don't need them hardly ever. And so by the time like it snows and you're like, oh, hey, we actually have snow, like all the sleds are gone. So
first time homeowners prepped for the by buying a sled and not a shovel or de-icer or anything legitimately useful. You're just like, we need a sled. And then stopped there, and then we couldn't leave for a week. So
it sounds like you did it right.
We've got a shovel now.
We just spent like literally, I probably got carbon monoxide poisoning a little bit, but we just spent like the whole time inside with a fire, and it was fantastic. Yeah,
fireplace.
Yeah, it was nice. Yeah, so some big things coming up in April. You've got an anniversary, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, April 3rd. We got married 4/3.
Wait, what? 4/3?
April's 4th on the 3rd in 2021.
So okay, that's 4/3/2/1. Did y'all plan it that way?
Yeah, obviously. Okay. we figured out like a time of year we wanted to get married, and then just we were like, be cool if there was a fun date, and then there was.
So did you guys go to like an Elvis Easter service, or was that a thing?
Why?
I mean...
I've never been to an Easter service in my life.
If I was, I'm just
not going to choose to go on the day after my wedding.
Good point. But your mother-in-law was, right? Well, she was like trying to find like an Easter service in Vegas.
Yeah, she asked about churches. Yeah, there's plenty of chapels, but I don't know about churches. I think I don't even remember what we ended up doing.
I'm just thinking if I was like an Elvis impersonator in Vegas, like that, it seems like it would be a prime time, like how Elvis Easter in your chapel.
Dressed as Elvis with like bunny ears?
No.
I don't go to Easter services. I don't know what they do there.
Most of the time it doesn't involve bunny ears, right. But it doesn't involve Elvis either,
that's
to be
less
fair.
Fun.
But I'm just thinking, you know, it'd be like a church service, but Elvis is like the pastor.
I mean,
that'd be interesting. I think it would have an audience.
Maybe make me religious if it's the right Elvis impersonator.
Yeah.
You gotta have that passion. We had a good one.
Like Elvis had like a gospel.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Like he did phase. Lots of gospel music. Yeah. And yeah. It's great music.
So it could be a whole thing. It could be a whole thing. Yeah.
Again, gotta be a good impersonator for that.
That's
though.
True. That's true. Or, yeah.
Ours was kind of a older Italian Elvis. But he was great. He was great. He's very enthusiastic. Took his duty very seriously.
You were the Elvis officiated your
yes.
wedding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yep. what was what were the highlights of that?
He sang two songs. We got to choose those songs.
Which
not his
which
full
did you choose?
Catalog. Love Me Tender was my walk in song, and then left to.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
He officiated. He signed our paperwork. It doesn't say Elvis, even though it has his real name. Yeah, they had a gift shop. It's great. We literally have matching t-shirts.
Did you walk out through the gift shop, like on the procession out?
No.
No?
Oh. No, but we did get matching t-shirts that say I got married by the king in Vegas.
So were both of y'all like diehard Elvis fans?
No.
Or this is just a crazy thing? Y'all are just like, let's just do this thing.
I mean, marriage is kind of crazy and dumb in a lot of ways.
Yeah, true.
So it was more of like, if we're going to do this, we're going to have fun with it and be ridiculous. But our relationship, us, so. Guidelines, and neither of us are religious. That didn't factor in at all.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, speaking of things that are wild and crazy, our brains. And today, our podcast... guest is someone who has been studying human behavior and behavioral marketing, behavioral psychology, all those things for quite some time. She is the host of the Brainy Business Podcast, which is one of my favorite podcasts to listen to. The links to all these things, by the way, are going to be in our show notes, so go check them out. But I want to introduce you to Melina Palmer. She's an expert in behavioral marketing. Her podcast has over 1 million episodes downloaded at this point. So I think she just crossed that limit. We just crossed a similar limit. It has less zeros, but it was still a pretty significant thing for us.
A few less zeros. Yeah,
don't give it away. I mean, it could be 100.
I didn't say the number.
Could be 100, could be 100,000. You never know. So, yes. But hers, million episodes downloaded. I think she's coming close to 400 episodes, definitely worth checking out. And she has some of the world's most renowned guests on there in terms of marketing, like such as Robert Cialdini, Rory Sutherland. She's also written 3 books. Her latest is The Truth About Pricing. Her other 2 are What Your Customer Wants and Can't Tell You and What Your Employees Need and Can't Tell You. She's also currently the instructor for Applied Behavioral Economics Certification at Texas A&M's Human Behavior Laboratory. And when she's not doing all that, she's assembling Lego orchids, which we found out. Didn't even know it was a thing. She's doing it.
Yeah, I didn't know you were going to tie that in now. Yeah, the Lego flowers are super cool.
Yeah.
I love them.
So without further ado, let's get this fire blazing with Melina Palmer. Well, Melina, thanks for coming on the podcast with us.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
We're looking forward to talking about and just diving into behavioral economics, how that's works with marketing. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into behavioral economics.
Sure. So my undergrad is in marketing, you know, business administration and marketing. And when I was doing that degree, I came across that one of my classes had, you know, one section of one chapter of one book, just this little tiny glimmer that was talking about buying psychology and why people do the things they do. And I thought it was just super fascinating. And at that moment had said, oh, I'm going to get a master's in this. I'm so excited. I hadn't even thought about further education at that point. But I was just all in, like super excited. And I ended up spending 10 years calling schools and asking about it and them saying, it's not a thing, it's not a program, it doesn't exist, either too bad or, you know, but you can come make the program if you want with us. It's like, well, don't need to pay you if I knew what I needed to learn. So maybe not. So anyway, right. I went into industry and was working in marketing and brand strategy and ended up being in what I kind of call a fellowship, like an innovation fellowship for financial institutions, specifically credit unions, and was in this two-year program. And one of the sessions we were in, they brought in some researchers from the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University, and it's their behavioral economics wing. They were talking about the research they were doing. And I realized that this is what I had been looking for the better part of a decade, trying to find. And they told me.
Did you say it was the Institute of Advanced Hindsight?
Yeah. The Center for Advanced Hindsight. Cool name, huh?
That is. sounds almost made up, but it's.
I feel like the best programs sound like they have made up names, right? That's the.
Very whimsical. Sounds like, you know, something out of Harry Potter.
I was going to say it's like super Narnia-esque, right? Yeah. Like if you find your way in. And I think behavioral economics is a lot of that too, as people start to learn about how our brains really work. And it's different than we think. It's whether you say like it's Oz, you know, behind the curtain or something. It just it unlocks something that I think is really cool. And I love being a part of that. So after hearing about the field and getting a proper name for it, I found myself a master's in behavioral economics and jumped right into that. And at that point, realized I knew I was early, right, since I'd been looking for a long time. But on the applied side, there was even less of people talking about this, of how you actually use this stuff. The field was really, really academic at that time when I found it. And so being able to know how this applies to brand strategy and internal communication and pricing and things like so much that felt so obvious to me. Just nobody was talking about it on an applied industry side. And that sort of turned into a why not me, and hit it at the right moment. And everybody started to find the podcast when I started it. And it just went from there.
It's interesting how it's evolved over the last, my experience with it has been over the last couple of years and just what I've seen. I think I really first came into contact with the idea when I was reading Rory Sutherland's book, the dark, you know what I'm talking about? The Dark
Alchemy.
Art of
yeah.
Alchemy. Yes. Fantastic book, by the way. But I was reading that, and I think maybe he referenced maybe some Kahneman and Tversky or something, and I was like, all right, I want to dig a little more into this, and then wound up finding your podcast, and I was like, okay, I'm hooked. I love this. and so I think you've really helped kind of push it out into the forefront of this is a valuable thing for marketing to take into consideration. But maybe we should backtrack just a little bit and say what is behavioral economics, and maybe people might be a little more familiar with like behavioral psychology, and like how do the two overlap, how do they differ? Can you speak to that?
For sure. So I like to just say, you know, if traditional economics and psychology had a baby, we get behavioral economics. And you may also hear the term, you know, behavioral science is something that's getting a lot of traction these days as a term too, and there's questions of when you use one versus the other, how they overlap. I tend to see them to be pretty interchangeable. Not everyone thinks that the terms are interchangeable. You know, I think for the level that most, especially that are listening here, would use it, I think it's kind of fine to use them, both behavioral economics, behavioral science. Really, it's about understanding how the brain really makes decisions versus how we think it should. And what the way that I use it is applying with businesses so you can get customers to buy and employees to buy in. So that internal communication and external communication, and knowing that, you know, how we say something matters. The communication is so important in whether someone loves an idea or totally rebels against it. Whether, you know, ideas good or bad is typically less important than how it all comes across. And so, I mean, that's kind of the initial nutshell version of what the field is. One of the reasons it really matters is, like I was saying about our brains, you know, we all have them, but we don't necessarily understand how they work, even though we really think that we know our own brain and everybody else, which is part of the, you know, feature set of how we're programmed. With that, though, is to realize and recognize. So research shows that humans make 35,000 decisions every single day on average, each person, 35,000. And now if I ask you, you know, both of you here as well as the listener, you know, how many decisions do you remember making yesterday?
Right.
Yeah, not many.
Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe, you know, if you really sit and think about it, we could come up with 25 or maybe 100, but like 35,000, mm-hmm. there's just no way we're getting into all of them. And it's because you have subconscious processing that is having to go through and make the bulk of those decisions. We couldn't exist if we had to consciously make all of those decisions. And so that processing power is using predictability, status quo, habits, rules of thumb to get through the bulk of what we're doing every single day. What behavioral economics and behavioral science is doing is understanding the rules that are being used to make decisions so you can communicate better with them. So that's where I'm saying in the how the brain actually makes decisions instead of how we think it should.
Yeah, I think it's so, all of it is like really interesting to me because I'm a super why person. Mm. So knowing why we do the things we do is fun. Like I was at the grocery store the other day and there was these like granola bars and the packaging was like spot on, totally got my attention. And then I looked closer at the picture and I was like, oh, that does not look like something I even remotely want to eat. But the packaging got with that worked for me and it tricked my little brain. So I love learning all of the whys and how everything ties in. So how, for like taking advantage of that, how do you recommend for marketers or businesses to start like really leaning into it and utilizing all of it to the best of their abilities?
For sure. So one is being really thoughtful, asking good questions. So, you know, Jeremy knows I end every episode of the Brainy Business podcast by saying, be thoughtful. It's my email signature. It's like our motto around here at the Brainy Business. And being thoughtful is both to, you know, be a kind and generous person, important. Also asking questions about our own behavior, right? So when you look at the grocery store experience you were talking about, to take a minute and go, why did I stop and look at this? Is it because of where it was placed? Was it a color that was contrasting with something else? Did I not expect it to be where it was? Was it the font? Was it, you know, like, why was I drawn to this moment? Thinking about, I wonder why they put this on this shelf instead of that one. And knowing there's a lot of intentionalism behind things that we don't realize for sure. And so getting those insights, and also from your email, right? It's amazing how we have a real big spam detector for everyone else. And then you sit and write that LinkedIn pitch and it's the spammiest, worst connection that anyone's ever written, but you can't, like, can't get out of your own way where it's like, I don't, no, this is great. Someone wants this. And if you got that message, you'd be like, bleh, like, no. So being able to think, you know, look at, ask the question, why did I like this email? What made me think this one was absolutely spam? You know, whatever those things are, can help as you're learning to then kind of turn around and be presenting information and moving forward. So again, when I was talking about that conscious and subconscious piece, our two systems of the brain don't speak to each other very well. They really don't communicate at all. And what happens, you know, we buy a lot of the actions we're doing every single day is on that subconscious level. And when we sit down and think, what do people do? What do they want? I'm going to create a product. I'm going to create an ad. You're in conscious brain trying to think about how to communicate to what you think is how you want things, but it's just really not. So being able to understand that disconnect and starting to ask thoughtful questions is a really, really good place to start. One other tip that I would give for this has to do with all of our senses. We tend to neglect the senses a lot, knowing that that's a huge amount of how we're taking in information. And yes, 70% of our sense receptors are coming from our eyes, but things like smell are really going to drive behavior in a way that when we think about how to present information, we just kind of forget. So an example of this would be there was a gas station that wanted to sell more coffee, right? You stop at the gas station, you want people to come in and get a cup of coffee. And the typical thing you would think of to communicate that is there's an ad on the thing that someone's stuck looking at and maybe they decide to come in, right? Or there was a 10 cents off coffee sign over the door that you hope is going to make somebody want to walk over and come into the store. But what this coffee or this stand did, this gas station, is they had the scent of coffee come in at the pumps. So you could smell it, and the sales of coffee went up 300%.
That's fantastic.
Right. A simple thing, and we think like the bakery that has that scent that draws you in, like it doesn't, for people that don't drink coffee, that aren't interested, they're not, it's not super in your face, but that little nudge of, oh man, I could use a coffee. I'm going to go. And you may also have the sign that says it's 10 cents off or you get something, whatever. But that sense of smell is really triggering on behavior and people forget about it all the time.
Yeah, it's a little less tangible in some ways and it's hard to see the cause and the effect of it. But I've read recently in biology, B-U-I, ology, they're saying
yes.
that people are more likely, especially for retail businesses. So the gas station, the bakery, even shopping, clothing stores, you're more likely to return if it has a good scent, like if it smells good. Mm-hmm. And I think like that's totally true, but I see it more on the opposite level. If I go somewhere and it has a bad smell, I'm probably not going to go there. There's a restaurant in town, and there's one spot where if I get sat at the spot, nobody else can smell it, but I smell this like musty mildew thing, and that has totally like ruined my experience, and I never really want to go there anymore. So our brains are weird. Yeah.
Yes. So, was that a question? I feel like agreed. Yes. So funny enough, just to build on that, the original talk, you know, before my first book came out, the talk that I would give on the just general buying behavior and behavioral economics, why it matters, was called Consumers Are Weird. That was the name of the talk. So agreed. That's that.
So, go ahead.
You're fine. I was just going to ask, with your experience, have there been any unexpected tactics that have worked or anything weird or surprising, anything you weren't sure was going to work? And then you were like, oh, no, for whatever reason, this tricked people.
Well, I wouldn't say tricked, but yes, the case with... The thing about behavioral economics is so often the thing that you feel like won't work or the thing that seems like way out there is so often the thing that does work. And so there's actually a couple examples that come to mind. But one is there's a guy, his name is Steve Wendell, and he talks about a research project they were doing. So one test things with a control group with some purpose that you're going into it with, so you can actually see difference and lift and stuff, right? It's, we don't want to say, I feel like that did better than it would have. Not helpful. Whereas if we go and run a test and something that we were sure was going to work didn't, but this other random thing did, you're able to tell instead of going on that gut, which is often not correct. So he was talking about how they were doing for statements for a financial institution that had to do with trying to get people to understand, like, constant ATM fee usage was adding up in a way that it's detrimental to you, that you don't necessarily, like, plan and get $200 instead of going and get $20 10 times. You don't have these sorts of fees and things. And so on the statements, they wanted to draw attention to it. And they had, you know, the call out box, and they had the different logical things that you would do. And one of the things they tested was this, the machine looked like a monster that was eating your money. And it seems silly and ridiculous. But of course, that performed the best because it stands out differently, hits your brain in a little bit of a different way. And so testing those kind of weird things, it often will be surprising what ends up working. I know, you know, another example that comes up a lot too when I was saying about that conscious subconscious problem is, so my book is called What Your Customer Wants and Can't Tell You for a reason, because a lot of issues we get when you go into a focus group is the same problem, you know, or a survey. You ask people, would you like this? Do you want to buy on this thing? Why or why not? And when you sit and have this conscious reflection of saying, do I like this? But maybe, what if, blah, blah, you put way more into it than you do in that instant moment. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so things like loss aversion, we consciously don't think we're going to like things being taken away, but FOMO is a real thing, right? We know that we have that and that we don't like to lose things, but because of when we think about it on a conscious level, we say, I would hate if a message told me that I was going to miss out on something because I don't like the idea of missing out on things, because you're just twisted in the way that you think you would react. And so, you know, there are multiple tests where people say, like, I hate this idea, and if you do it, I'm going to leave, or I've never want it, and it'd be terrible. And then they go ahead and run it, and which one performs the best? Yeah. Is that one that people said that they wouldn't like. So it's not, you know, there are legitimately things that if someone says they won't like it and they're going to leave, they really will. And something like scarcity, using things like loss aversion in that messaging, may feel like people are going to hate it, but it doesn't always come out that way.
We run into this a lot with, like, branding and messaging and logos, because no matter what happens, that person that we're designing a logo for will take it to a friend, a trusted colleague, and say, what do you think? And so I just learned a while back just to say, please don't ask people what they think. You know, just because it switches their brain out of that intuitive system one type of thinking, and they start thinking, oh, well, if that was just a little rounder, or if that color was different, I would like it better. And
it is this interesting sort of a conundrum, right, where you do want to get those real world sort of like moment responses, but when we switch into that conscious response, it can throw things off. So, you know, there are really interesting ways to be doing testing of, like, implicit response, where you can have test where, let's say, an image comes or a word comes up and it says good. And then another, and you have to click, does this say good or bad, right? And you say good. And then the next thing comes up and it says bad, and click, does it say good or bad? And you say, okay, it's like, left is bad, right is good, the word is good, click the thing. And so it's recording in microseconds how quickly you say good, bad, based on the word that's there. And then it'll show you an advertisement for something, and the word will say, it's good, right? And if it takes you that tiny microsecond longer to hit good. It's because you actually thought it was bad. And so there's this little bit of dissonance in your brain that took something that, like, we couldn't intuit, we couldn't get it in that discussion because you don't even realize it. But that tiny fraction of a second that it took longer to click good or beautiful or whatever it is that you're testing for, the system can pick up on and be able to realize that actually people may think this is bad, but they wouldn't have been able to tell us, you know, with words.
That is fascinating. Train of thought. Jess, you got one?
Well, I am excited to hear a little bit more about your podcast and what made you want to start that. What was that process like for you? And because you've been, you're 370-ish episodes.
Yeah, it's a big interesting world where I live in the future of the podcast, right? So I'm planning for episode 400 now, knowing that it's coming very soon. And yes, we're in those high 300s of episodes. The show came out, it's called The Brainy Business, and it came out in 2018 and was weekly for a very long time. And we started doing two times a week about a year and a half ago. As far as why I started it is, you know, being this is a marketing podcast, everyone will super get this, right? So I realized that, like I said, when I got into behavioral economics and realizing how much this applied to marketing, I had also just recently started doing consulting full time. And I kind of thought that originally the behavioral stuff was just going to layer in and I was going to be like a marketing consultancy doing ad strategy, brand stuff, all that. And realized, whoa, actually, like, this is a whole thing I should be leading with versus this sort of supplemental space. And I also realized, because nobody knew what it was not a term that anyone was talking about by any means, going to a company and saying, hey, marketing people, there's this thing, it's called behavioral economics. I know that name kind of sucks, and it doesn't sound like something you're excited about, but let me tell you, it's really, really cool, and it matters to you, and this is all of how it works, and this is stuff about the brain. It's really a big deal. You should totally hire someone to help you with it, and it should be me. Right. Like, that's like the world's worst sales pitch. There's no way that that works. So I set up the podcast just as like a warm lead generator, as well as a place to be able to get, you know, my own thoughts put together. It's ended up being a place where I build out frameworks that then have turned into books and things like that, and the work I do with clients and everything. And with the show, again, when I launched it, no one was really talking about this. So come to find out, you know, I landed square in the middle of a really blue ocean that there wasn't any other podcast in the world on behavioral economics and business that was set up like mine. And so as people, it was a tipping point for the field as people were starting to search with the term. And when you would go in Apple Podcasts or anywhere else, mine was the first or sometimes the only show that would come up. And so that led to, you know, people all over the world finding it and talking about it, which is amazing and definitely went well beyond any of what I ever expected the show was going to do. And what I've heard over the years, a reason why it really resonates with people, something that I didn't even realize was sort of a superpower of mine, is being able to read academic research and very quickly know this is what this means in normal speak. This is how you would apply it. This is how it could go over here. You could try it over there. You could do it like this and be able to explain it to people in a way that they can then go do something with it. Apparently, most brains don't work that way, as what's really clear for me. And so that applicability and feeling confident that you can go do something with this and go do that little test, jump in and try a little something, I think has really resonated with the audience, and it makes people want to share and try, and that's really great. So yeah, now The Brainy Business has, like we said, almost 400 episodes. We have almost 1.2 million downloads from over 170 countries. And so it's just lots of people wanting to learn about communicating better with other humans, which helps me just feel good about the future of the world too, right?
Yeah.
It is a fantastic podcast. I highly recommend it to any of our listeners to go check it out. You're like our podcast big sibling. So we look up to you.
I appreciate it.
You've also got three books. The Truth About Pricing is the latest. Tell us about the summary of that. What are some of the high points? Why should people check it out?
Oh, for sure. Well, as I said, three books. So the first one, in What Your Customer Wants and Can't Tell You, is a lot of what we're saying here, just overarching understanding of brain and understanding consumer behavior and the whys of stuff. I also have What Your Employees Need and Can't Tell You, which is on that internal communication side. The Truth About Pricing is one of those books that is, so for one, people hate pricing. I've learned over the years, everyone hates it. Very, very few people are like in love with the idea of pricing. And when we think about how we're going to sell something, how we talk about it, it again, it's this point that gets really convoluted. And especially if you have any people with smaller businesses that are listening versus being at a big corporation, you end up where it just, you get in your own head about pricing in a way, you know, you should think about it, you know, you should do something about it, but it like is a forever tomorrow sort of task, right? That's like, when I have more time next week, after this thing's done, we'll really sit down and talk about and think about the pricing. We have to do research, and you build it into this big old thing. And then sometime you wake up and realize that your launch is in 3 days and you haven't finalized the price, and you go, okay, we'll just go like a dollar less than the competition, or we'll do this percentage markup on something. And once we get through the launch in 6 months, we'll revisit pricing and we'll really do it right. And we know how that goes, right? You just never really get there.
It's a never ending story. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, being confident about your price and being able to talk about it in a way that you can frame it properly, that you're positioning it in the right way, has all the difference as to whether someone wants to buy or not. The Truth About Pricing I give you on page 3 of the book, which is, price isn't about the price. Everything that happens before matters more than the price itself. And so the book is as close to the please just do this for me, which I know is where most people are when they're working on pricing, to give you, like when I work with clients, all the questions we ask, the things we look at, the pieces to work on, to be able to figure out all of your stuff before the price, and then how to position the way that you talk about it in a way that is going to be most likely to be attractive to your ideal customer and make it so they are already bought in before they even hear what the price is, and it almost becomes a non-issue.
We tend to see issues with that with like service-based businesses, especially like if it's B2B kind of consultant or any sort of service-based business where it's more your time, right? Your time and your expertise. The biggest hurdle we try to get people across is recognizing the value of it. That it's okay to charge something that you're going to be happy with and make a decent living off of. I think some people undervalue. Do you see that in your research? Is that kind of across the board?
Yes. Yeah. And like you say, with service-based stuff, you don't even have the baseline of like my fixed costs are this. And so, right, like you say, that percentage markup of having something to start with. And the real issue for a lot of people in a service-based industry is you are typically not your ideal client in a whole lot of ways, but you would never need to buy the thing that you've built a business on because you're intuitively good at the thing. And that's like for marketing for me, it's hard for me to price that type of work because of how quickly I do it. I will almost always undervalue to someone that is really bad at it. It would take them so much longer than I can imagine to do that work that the value, the way that they think about it is different than the way that if I think about what I would be willing to pay or invest in that work, because I could just do it myself, right? But they typically can't, and they're not going to get there. So disassociating from that is really important. And then there are a few tips, even like I said, in the way you present the information. So if you're uncomfortable with your pricing, it's kind of this like how dogs can smell fear, right? If you're not confident in it, people pick up on it and think something's wrong, even if they can't say, you know, you said that weird, but I trust you, right? It's if you're not confident, there, why would they be? And that's, so if you have issues where people ask for discounts, they're, you know, nudging into all these other areas that it's like, oh man, no one ever buys the thing I want them to buy. It doesn't mean that the thing is wrong. You are probably just presenting it wrong. So if you go in and say, well, we've got this package and it's $5,000. And I know that seems like a lot. It's probably difficult. We just raised the rate. So, I mean, if you needed to, you know, maybe do $3,500 or something, or if you wanted to make payments, I mean, we have options. We can make it work for you if it feels like it's not okay. Like, they haven't even asked for anything yet, but you can be darn sure that they feel like you're not worth that price, no matter what it was, whether it was $50,000.
I've never done that, ever, ever. I've never done that.
Never, never. Nope.
Never.
Yes.
Not me.
So if instead, you know, even if you were just to say it's $5,000 and most people start this way and this is how this works. So a couple things there. Confidently saying, you know, you could say it's just $5,000 to get started. And most people, that's a herding thing, right? So we are a herding species. So having that social proof of other people have bought this and they feel good, they move forward in this way, is reassuring for someone when they're stepping into a new, something they haven't done before, which is typically when you're trying to get them to buy from you for the first time. Another thing that people tend to get wrong is we feel like we need to start with the, you know, you start at the bottom and you work your way up when you're talking about packages or options for working with you. Couple problems. You get people anchored on that lowest price item that you probably don't really want them to buy. And then the thing you really want feels really expensive compared to that intro thing. So they just sort of stop there. And you want to start high and work your way down then. And the thing you really want people to buy should not be the most expensive thing that you sell. That's just generally not the way that you want that to go. And so if you did want to sell that $5,000 thing, right? So if you say, well, we have some options that, you know, for, you know, $250 an hour, you could get started and do a couple of one-off things. But we do recommend this $5,000 package, you know, $5,000, you could come work with us. How does that sound? You go, no, I think I'll start at $250 an hour. We'll let you know. Like, not interested.
Right.
If you say there's this, you know, we have this version, it's $10,000. It's really robust and potentially more than most people need. Instead of just doing a standard logo, we have options with 4-color process instead of a 2-color process. And we're creating an animated version for you. We're setting up PowerPoint templates and a video animated version. You know, we have that really big package for $10,000 for the brands that need it. But, you know, most people, we have this $5,000 package, which has a 2-color process. You have 3 rounds of edits and feedback. And we give you, you know, vertical, horizontal, all the types that you may need and, you know, color packet. How does that sound? Which one feels like the best fit for you? They might actually say like, hey, like animated logo sounds pretty cool. I like that. Well, I mean, it's not that much more. They might end up getting that thing. But if they, then that $5,000 thing feels much more reasonable because right. We started with the big thing first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Yeah. No, before I was in marketing, I was in the beauty industry and I was a stylist and I came up with my own pricing and I relate to all of this. Like I'm having salon flashbacks of like certain clients where I was like, I know they're not going to want to pay this, but this is what they need. And like, yeah, I heavily relate to all of it. It's
right.
Very real.
And if you can confidently say like, hey, I don't want to let you leave with, I know that this is what you think, you're asking for this. And I'm going to tell you, it's not going to come out the way that you want. We're talking about my mm-hmm. hair. Like, I would like to know, please. Right? Like,
yeah. I'm just curious. What's the $10,000 equivalent in hair?
In
would
hair?
Would you be like, you get the perm and the coloring and the...
You don't do perm and color the same day, but any kind of major color correction. If you got to strip out color and then put in new color and you probably need a haircut and there's decent chance you need an eyebrow wax too, but it's real hard to tell people you need an eyebrow wax without offending anyone. It's a delicate balance, man. I mean, in any service industry, I guess, but yeah.
I've heard of the same principle being applied with restaurant pricing. So the menu, so when you're looking at the menu, a lot of the times restaurants, when they're thinking through this, they'll put the most expensive thing very first, and they don't expect to sell that thing. Yeah. It's almost like a throwaway item, but it just anchors people to that item. And so the next prices down seem very reasonable.
Yeah. In my work and in The Truth About Pricing, I talk about this in finding a wingman. So what you want to have is you have your best offer. The thing that you know people really should get that you think is the best most of the time, right? You have that 80-20 sort of rule, right? And you want to make sure whatever you're building out as the best offer is also something that's profitable for you and that you're going to like the work. Those are important details when we're building out that thing. And, you know, through the book helps to think about different aspects for that. So once you've built out that best offer, you want to think about its features, its benefits, like why do people want this thing? And then you can build its wingman. And the wingman's job is not to be bought. If someone does buy it, you want to be sure that you would be delighted that they do get it. So don't build in a product that's got a bunch of handholding and a lot of things that you don't want to do, because if someone buys it, you don't want to be upset, right? So you build out something that you'd be really happy with. So if it is like, hey, you can work with me and we get a full day together. And if you come to me, it's $10,000, right? But we also have this option that's we go to Italy for a week and we will get to work together and you pay for the travel and whatnot. But we get 3 full days, hanging out in Italy, working on your business stuff. That's a $30,000 package. And we just have this, you know, if you just want the one day, we do something, it's $10,000. If someone buys that, I am delighted, let me tell you. Most people won't, but like, that's a win. We want to sell that one.
I think we might need an Italy product of some sort.
Okay.
Let's do it.
You don't have to ask me twice.
Yeah.
So in your experience, what is the craziest, the weirdest thing or the weirdest way people behave in regard to pricing? What sticks out the most to you?
There are a few things that I think just in natural human tendency that when you stop and think about it is super weird, which has to do with just anything to do with brands, right? So even, and we think about a purse, a bag, anything, right? So a 5-cent plastic bag would serve the purpose of what most, like utility-wise, of what any purse does. And most anyone would say that's absolutely ridiculous, right? And the $10 faux leather bag or whatever would do the same function as that Kate Spade or the Birkin bag, right? Whatever it is that you're going to get. But it's not. And we don't see them in the same way. And what it says, again, about when we think about that social proof and herding mentality being a part of the tribe and how we stand out, social status, brands become a part of our identity in the way that it says something about you. And, you know, then you look at like hipster style, right? Of like, I want to go on the total anti to prove a different point, but then it becomes its own setup, right? It's a very interesting thing, the way we make statements and are willing to invest in something because of what we think it says about us and how we want to be seen outside of the utility itself. And even if you think, well, that's dumb, people shouldn't do that, we will. We do. That's how we work and operate. And one of the brands I talk about in The Truth About Pricing is Supreme. And I find this to be just the most fascinating brand around. And things with the Supreme logo on them become exorbitantly more expensive than when they don't have it, even, again, if the function doesn't change at all. And they use really extreme scarcity. They have time pressure and different aspects that go into why that works for them. But like the Pyrex measuring cup, if you were to buy just like the 2-cup measuring cup, as it stands, it's about $5. They put one with the Supreme logo on it that was like a co-brand of the measuring cup, which is exactly the same, Supreme Red is basically the same color. You almost don't even notice it, but that retailed at $25 for the same thing, and it sold out. And then you go to buy it resale, and it's selling for like $200 for people wanting to get a 2-cup measuring cup that's exactly the same as this other one. They also have sold clay bricks for hundreds of dollars and crowbars and matchsticks, and it's fascinating. So I find that brand to be amazing.
I think it says something about that we're not just buying a thing, we're buying really the way it makes us feel, the experience of it. And it's hard mentally, even if we try to do it, it's almost impossible to separate all of that from the price.
Right. And it is something that's important for brands to understand in that genuine human experience, and to know that it's not bad to be in that space, right? If somebody's wanting to be able to, we can bond over being Kate Spade people or whatever it is. And I see that you have the thing and I love the thing. And like when I'm saying something with my many rose golds cups and things that I have, right? And so someone is able to bond over that with me. And that's something that drives human behavior, that we want to connect with other people. And so what's really interesting too is our brains are wired that they tend to get what they expect. My friend Matt Johnson, who co-authored a really great book called Blind Sight, in the book, he wrote it with Prince Guman, and they talk about how, you know, if there's a shoe, if I believe that a shoe makes me run faster and jump higher, who's to say that it doesn't? Right. And so way we interconnect with brands when they're executed in a really amazing way is just a really cool kind of meta experience about how like we make the brand and it makes us, and how that mindset can shift and change. And looking for ways that you can be a part of your ultimate, your best customer's identity is a way that you can, they're more likely to be loyal to you. You become a favorite. They're going to talk about it. They become an advocate. And it's just a really cool opportunity, I think.
So looping back around to general behavioral economics and how it applies to marketing, how can a marketer take something that by all rationality shouldn't work, right? And they go and they have to present this to an executive team or somebody else that's helping make decisions. And they say, hey, we've got this idea. Here it is. And how do they sell something that it appears that it shouldn't work, but they know that it really will? How do you get over that hurdle?
So again, this is confidence comes into play of understanding why you believe it will work. And you need to, first and foremost, whether you're pitching to the C-suite or you're pitching a product to an ultimate end user, is you need to understand what they care about and communicate those things that are important to them in the way that you present your pitch. And so the way you would talk about the value of an idea to the CFO is going to be different than to the COO, right? Or someone that's leading up the marketing team, if that wasn't you. And so being able to think about what they care about and give information in their language, right? Of their love language, essentially, of what they would get excited about is really important. And showing that you have this holistic understanding of the value that this is going to provide for the company, and not just be thinking about why you think it would be cool or something, or and helping them to see that that's not what you're doing, that you're not trying something new that's going to be a big risk for them. And in that way, you can have a lot of other detail and information for if there are follow-up questions, but presenting with, I always tell people to try to find the least amount of words that you can use when presenting something to get the other person to make a choice. So we may feel like we need all the facts and all the figures and all the things and all the options, all the charts, all the. And that's super overwhelming for people. They tune out whether you would like them to or not. We just naturally do. So if you communicate clearly in a way that is showing value that they care about, And then you can talk about, you know, more about the overall company and whatnot. Less is more when it comes to a good pitch. And that also comes into the research that you might be wanting to showcase. So as you start learning about behavioral economics, and hopefully everyone's excited to go learn more. And if you get my books and you start listening to the podcast and you have all the research and citations and things, and you want to say, and this is loss aversion, and then we've got anchoring, and then here's this other thing, and we could do this, and we could get da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. If they're not there yet, it can be really overwhelming. And you also don't have to go in and be pitching like, this is my new job, we need this. Like I was saying with the podcast, like why I started that instead of having that really terrible sales pitch to people that aren't ready. You can have some information about how it's backed in science and maybe show one example of how this comes into play that can tie into what this person values. So like again, with the CFO, what's the ROI? How's it going to help us on profitability? What's this going to do for something else for the organization? And you can be layering in the behavioral stuff, but don't have to be so explicit with it or whatever it is that you're trying to get a shift in behavior. Too much change often can get negated. That's why what your employees need and can't tell you exists.
Yeah. So all of that with your books and your podcast and your consulting, what has been your biggest marketing mountain you've conquered or biggest takeaway from all of it?
I would say that the most important thing to know is that everything matters. Even the littlest thing that you think shouldn't is important. We want to be looking at micro moments, micro decisions, those teeny tiny things that can have a huge impact on behavior. And that's where being thoughtful comes into play. So being aware of all those little nuances is really important, and finding the balance so that you don't get into your own way so much that you think, oh my gosh, if everything matters, I have to do all the research and all the things and I never can actually start. So everything matters, and you can start doing little tests right away. And there are ways to start doing something to see if it can work, to get some proof that you can then go use in that eventual pitch, right? So for marketing, you could test out the way you frame your subject line. You could test the way you use color. You can test out how you're going to use a big button instead of a small button, or if you want to use just anchoring in the way that you position and talk about the wingman type of product that doesn't need you to go get big approval from somewhere. Again, have a control so you can show the lift. This doesn't work if you just say, we're pretty sure it made a difference. Whereas if you say, hey, we had a 38% increase in click-throughs when we anchored in this way, and we'd love to be able to invest more in this because that translated into $10,000 extra dollars for the company or whatever, right? When you can say it in that way, it's kind of hard to say no to. So little tests you can start doing. You don't need to make it huge, and know that, you know, even the littlest things can have the biggest difference.
Well, Melina, thank you so much for being a guest on here. We'll have links to your books and the podcast in our show notes, and encourage everybody to go take a listen and get some of those books and read or listen to those as well.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Marketing Trailblazers with Jeremy LaDuke and Jess Tackett is produced by me, Lance Pettiford, co-produced by Kaylee Eastep. Graphic and web design by Will Lunsford, and guest support provided by Kaylee Swaggerty. Marketing Trailblazers is a production of Epic 9 Marketing Outfitters, helping ambitious brands grow since 2014. If you are a CMO looking to conquer some mountains, or you need a CMO to help get you to the top, then contact Epic 9 and get started with a Basecamp consultation at epic9.com. Want more great content to help fuel your marketing adventures? Sign up for exclusive content and get early access to our Marketing Mountain School content at marketingtrailblazers.com.